This is the Bible Book Club. I'm Heather.
And I'm Susan.
And we're in the book of 1 Samuel.
Welcome to the club.
Last episode in chapters 10 through 12, God changed Saul's heart about being king, and all the signs that Samuel promised to build Saul's confidence happened. Samuel revealed God's choice for a king, but Saul was hiding among the supplies. Then God gives Saul a military victory against the Ammonites, and the people embrace Saul as king, and they celebrate him at Gilgal. Samuel once again warns them, though, that they and the king must not forget to fear and serve the Lord. Then Samuel sends them a finale with thunder and lightning, courtesy of God.
Yeah, he's trying to prove a point that this is not his words, but God's word. At this moment, Saul is looking good. He kind of passed that first test, had his first victory, and the Israelites are speculatively hopeful. For hundreds of years, and we have to kind of get ourselves in their head, the Israelites' head, they've been waiting for a promise that dates back to Genesis 3 and verse 15, which said this,
"And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel."
So put yourselves in their minds. They're really hopeful. God was speaking to the serpent. The promise God made was that one day an offspring of the woman would crush the serpent. So again, this is the history that they're familiar with. Then in Genesis 17:6, God promised Abraham that
"I will make nations of you and kings will come from you."
So God promised that Abraham and his nation, Israel, would have kings. So think of the Israelites. Finally, they get their king. And guess what he does? He defeats the king named Snake. Track with me here. The king of the Ammonites was named Nahash, which means snake or serpent. So to the Israelite, it looks like Saul is the long-awaited king, the offspring of the woman often called the second Adam, the one who crushes the serpent. But he's not. He is not that king, and his fall is fast.
So are you saying that you think at this point in the history, the Israelites are like, okay, the prophecy has been fulfilled, now we're good?
Correct. They think, we've waited and waited for this king, and we finally get the king. And then guess what? He defeats another king whose name means serpent or snake. So they're thinking, we've arrived.
It's a sign.
It's a sign. We've conquered the serpent and we have the king. So it's all going to be so great going forward, but it's not that king. Scene one, Saul begins his fall.
Chapter 13, Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years.
From now on, this is the Bible's way of introducing kings, and we're going to get a lot of this. We will learn their age at the beginning of their reign and the number of years that they served. Saul's reign, like many of the kings after him, will revolve around battles to defend the Promised Land. Israel's greatest fear and foe at this time was the Philistines. So Saul next sets out to prove his worth with the assistance from his son Jonathan.
Verse 2, Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel, 2,000 were with him in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. The rest of the men he sent back to their homes. Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, "Let the Hebrews hear." So all Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become obnoxious to the Philistines. And the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal.
The Israelites attacked first, led by Jonathan. Although credit goes to Saul for, you know, just blowing the trumpet. Then both sides gather their forces. A war is building.
Is this Jonathan, his son, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Verse 5, the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. When the Israelites saw that their situation was critical and that their army was hard-pressed, they hid in caves and thickets among the rocks and in pits and cisterns. Some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings," and Saul offered up the burnt offering.
It turns out the Philistines are powerfully intimidating. The Israelites chicken out and hide. Saul has got to make a move, but he can't until he enlists the Lord's blessing, and that requires Samuel. He must wait, but the pressure is mounting as the men are abandoning and the Philistines are advancing, and it was all just too much pressure. Something had to be done. God had the answers. Saul just needed to hear from him. So he tried to seek God without Samuel.
Verse 10, just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel.
Oh, no, this question, "What have you done?" is exactly the same thing God asked Adam way back in Genesis, hinting that this is not the promised Adam or offspring who would say them that they may have been suspecting was because the whole like serpent snake thing. This Adam or Saul is just like the first Adam, foolish and impulsive. And just like the first Adam, Saul makes excuses for his mistake.
Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering and that you did not come at the set time and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." "You have done a foolish thing," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." Then Samuel left Gilgal and went up to Gibeah in Benjamin, and Saul counted the men who were with him. They numbered about 600.
It was just one wrong move, but it revealed Saul's heart. As king, Saul should not make any decisions without word from God. That word would be delivered through a prophet or priest. In this case, Saul was told it would be Samuel, but Saul couldn't wait. He panicked under the pressure. We don't know whether Saul made the offering himself or if he tried to do it through another priest. If he tried to do it himself, he committed a really great sin. Saul may be king, but he was not qualified for priestly duties. The rules for the priesthood were extensive, and they're fascinating, actually. So you can check that out in Leviticus Season 3 of Bible Book Club. The bottom line is that Saul acted as though God would not act. Fear often leads to panic, and the only antidote to fear is faith. In every single situation, we must remember that God is in control, and we must trust him for the outcome. This was just one wrong move, but it was complete disobedience. Saul had failed a super important test of faith, and nowhere is it recorded that he responded to Samuel's words with any type of repentance. Israel's first king is told that he will not recover. His kingdom will not be established. I.e., what he's saying here is Saul's line will not be the one that produces that King of Kings to save Israel for all time. God has already chosen another king, a man after his own heart. Note for us, waiting on God was difficult then, and perhaps even more so today. We have technology that provides instantaneous information. As a result, our brains are wired to react. We have not been conditioned to wait to act. Do you stop to incorporate God into your decisions? And if God is silent, are you willing to wait? Or does your mind immediately drive for solutions of your own, like I confess mine does. In the chess game between Team Israel and Team God, the first king has actually already fallen. But what does that mean that it said, the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler? Is the game over? Will Team God and Team Israel always be opposed? Will they ever be on the same team? The answer is ultimately yes. Here's the Bible bender in the bigger story in the game to gain eternal life, whether you're playing chess or basketball, whatever it is. In the beginning of Israel's history, everyone was on one team, Team God. They were one family. Remember we talked about that? It was a patriarchal thing, remember? And it's interesting how God kind of portrayed this family team. He called Israel his son in Exodus 4. So Israel was just a family. Listen to what he said in 4:22.
Exodus 4, verse 22. Then say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says. Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so he may worship me.
Okay, so we have this picture of we are in God's family. We are part of his team. Then we get to where we are right now in this story. And Israel all of a sudden doesn't want to be a part of God's team. They want their own team. So they're kind of want this separation. They want to leave God, who is their king and their father. He's adopted them. He chose them out of all the other nations to be his son. So we have this picture of the son wanting to leave the father, or the son who wants to leave Team God. In the verse we just read, God foretells the choice of a new king. Remember, we've had this king Saul. Now we're moving to this new king who is a man after God's heart. That man is David. Well, when we get forward now, moving forward to 2 Samuel chapter 7, God again is going to go through this adoption process, because remember, he adopted Israel as his son. They rejected him. Now he's going to adopt David's son. Listen to what it says. It's so interesting.
2 Samuel 7, starting in verse 12. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will rise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son.
We see God pursuing us, always trying to adopt us. So now he's having to work through this king. God says that David's son will be his son. God is adopting the king of Israel as his son, representing the nation. Israel was God's son, but they wanted a king and they joined another team. But God brings them back by adopting their king as his son. And that king, David, is then going to begin the line to the birth of Christ, the true son of God. So again, we're going to make another jump there. And at Christ's baptism, now we jump to what God said when God says this in Matthew 3.
Matthew 3, verse 11. And a voice came from heaven, you are my son, whom I love. With you, I am well pleased.
And through this son, we're all going to be adopted. Jesus, then, is from the line of that adopted son, King David. And Jesus is also the true son of God. Through this Son of God, we are adopted. And this is where, in his great plan, God reunites Team God and Team People. The group that left him is now being reunited, because Jesus is the Son of Israel, the Son of David, and the Son of God. And he will rule God's people forever on one team. Game over. This is where the game ends. This is where God's great plan comes to fruition. From the beginning, there was only one outcome, one winning team, Team God. God, in his omniscience, prepared the way for all to join the team. Now note, Jesus, our King and team captain, has invited you to play on his team. See that invitation. Have you found your position? Have you scored any points for Team God? Are you having a good season or a bad one? Regardless of where you are as you play, I want to encourage you with this. consider this podcast as part of your training. So kudos to you for just being here and showing up for training. Training isn't always entertaining, but if you stay with it, the results come. It is our goal, Heather's and mine, that by the time we finish this entire Bible, you're going to be an all-star on Team God. So stick with it. Scene two, Saul's fall leads to Israel's suffering.
1 Samuel 13, verse 16, Saul and his son Jonathan and the men with them were staying in Gibeah in Benjamin while the Philistines camped at Michmash. Raiding parties went out from the Philistine camp in three detachments. One turned toward Ophrah in the vicinity of Shual, another toward Beth Horon, and a third toward the borderland overlooking the valley of Zeboim, facing the wilderness. Not a blacksmith could be found in the whole land of Israel because the Philistines had said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines to have their plow points, mattocks, and axes and sickles sharpened. The price was 2/3 of a shekel for sharpening plow points and mattocks, and 1/3 of a shekel for sharpening forks and axes for repointing goads. So on the day of the battle, not a soldier with Saul and Jonathan had a sword or spear in his hand. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had them.
All right, so consequences are happening here. Saul has made a mistake, and he's left with only 600 men and no weapons, and they can't get anywhere. The king they asked for, Saul, is powerless, and the nation is at great risk. Now, have I mentioned that the name of Saul means asked for? King Saul, the words literally mean, this is the king you asked for. Be careful what you ask for. What Israel asked for is not what Israel needed. Israel and all of humanity, including us, need a king who can actually rescue us from our enemies and rescue us from ourselves. A king with the power to resist the enemy and obey God without ever panicking. And Saul was not that man. Scene three, Jonathan is a son with saving faith. There have been several depraved sons on our journey, particularly in the book of Judges and even here in 1 Samuel, but Jonathan is not one of them. Jonathan has fearless, steadfast faith, and he reminds me of Joshua. And if you were with us in season 6, you know that I love Joshua. Now, in the book of Numbers, chapter 13, Moses sends 12 men to explore the promised land, and here's why I love Joshua. Two of the 12, Caleb and Joshua, saw a totally different picture than the other 10 explorers because Caleb and Joshua looked at the land through the lens of faith, while the others looked through the lens of fear. Jonathan, to me, is like Joshua. He steadfastly pursues God in faith, even when his very own father, Saul, strays and eventually threatens him. Now note, fear and faith are like sunglasses. They tint our perception. We all have a favorite pair of sunglasses. Which glasses are your go-to? Are you more inclined to look at the world tinted with fear or with faith? I challenge you because it can change every action you take for the Lord.
Continuing in verse 23. Now a detachment of Philistines had gone out to the pass at Michmash. And now going on to chapter 14. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men, among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. He was a son of Ichabod's brother Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh.
Okay, so I hope you're getting these little nuances here. Remember we read, I think it was last episode, that Jonathan attacks, but Saul blows the trumpet. Well, here we have Jonathan goes out again, and Saul is sitting under a pomegranate tree. These are just little asides, but I want you to note, we're kind of getting a picture of the situation here. Now, In this case, Saul has made an adjustment to his procedures after the last battle where Samuel chastised him for sacrificing without waiting for him. This time around, it appears that Saul is not taking any chances. He is carrying with him a priest, and not just any priest, but the high priest, Ahijah, the grandson of Phinehas, who was Eli's son, probably at the time was the high priest, and he was wearing the ephod to prove it. Now, this kind of feels like a Samuel slight to me, like a usurp of authority. Well, if I can't always have Samuel sitting in my pocket, I'm going to get the high priest and make sure that I've got access to that hotline to God. Meanwhile, Jonathan is still focused on the Philistines, and he is off on his own secret mission.
Continuing in verse 3, no one was aware that Jonathan had left. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez and the other Sinai. The cliff stood to the north toward Michmash, the other to the south toward Geba. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised men. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." "Do all that you have in mind," said his armor bearer. "Go ahead, I am with you heart and soul." Jonathan said, "Come on then, we will cross over toward them and let them see us. If they say to us, 'Wait here until we come to you,' we will stay where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands." So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. "Look," said the Philistines, "the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in." The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson." So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet with the armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed him and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area of about half an acre.
So this is kind of a little trick play, and actually it was used in more recent times, like I'm saying the last couple hundred years, by another group who read this Bible passage and came up with it as a plan for themselves. So it's kind of like there was this little passageway and it looked like you had more men behind you, which you really didn't, but it kind of intimidated the enemy. It was 2 against 20, which weren't great odds, but Jonathan looked at the enemies of the Lord through the lens of faith, and he said this,
"Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few."
So armed with faith and a sign from the Lord, Jonathan overpowers these Philistines, or uncircumcised men. We assume that they're probably part of the Philistines. Next, God multiplies Jonathan's act of fearless faith into a huge victory for Israel.
Verse 15, then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field and those in the outpost and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was panic sent by God. Saul's lookouts at Gibeah and Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. Then Saul said to the men who were with him, "Muster the forces and see who has left us." When they did, it was Jonathan and his armor bearer who were not there. Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God." At that time, it was with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all his men assembled and went to the battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel, and the battle moved on beyond Beth-Aven.
So remember, Saul and Jonathan are acting independently in this scene because Jonathan had gone off and done his own thing and then had triggered this whole Philistine panic. Saul does not know that the Philistines' army's retreat had anything to do with Jonathan, and Jonathan is unaware of his father's silly decrees, which we're going to get to. So in scene 5, Jonathan eats honey and Saul eats his words.
Verse 24. Now the Israelites were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. The entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. When they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out, yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath. So he reached out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened. Then one of the soldiers said to him, "Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be anyone who eats food today.' That is why the men are faint." Jonathan said, "My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey? How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater?"
So we see Saul kind of responding to his last mistake. He's got this priest in his pocket, the high priest, and he's got the ark. He marches out and he's put the Israelite army in distress by starving them. He's made this harsh decree that they are to fast even while they're fighting, and that if they break the fast, they would die. Why he ordered a fast for men in a very physical battle, we don't know. It was foolish. It is assumed that it was an attempt to appear godly or manipulate God. It was not from a good heart. Jonathan did not get the memo. And it almost kind of sounds like he and his armor bearer kind of rejoin the army and he eats some honey. And when he hears of it, that the decree, he responds disrespectfully to his father. He says, "My father has made trouble for the country." Now, no one else but a son would have dared defy Saul. But, you know, your kids don't, it doesn't matter if you're president or king, they're going to shoot straight with you. Jonathan sees the truth. His father is falling. He's being foolish. Now, sometimes our family members are the only ones daring enough to call us out when we're wrong, and we probably should listen to them because there's a little bit of truth in everything they say. Saul's foolish fast has put his very own son's life at risk, and it gets worse. The soldiers become so exhausted and hungry that they make a more sobering mistake.
Verse 31, that day, after the Israelites had struck down the Philistines from Michmash to Ajalon, they were exhausted. They pounced on the plunder, and taking sheep, cattle, calves, they butchered them on the ground and ate them together with the blood. Then someone said to Saul, "Look, the men are sinning against the Lord by eating meat that has blood in it." "You have broken faith," he said. "Roll a large stone over here at once." Then he said, "Go out among the men and tell them, 'Each of you, bring me your cattle and sheep, and slaughter them here and eat them. Do not sin against the Lord by eating meat with blood still in it.'" So everyone brought his ox that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first time he had done this.
So eating honey is not a sin, but eating meat with blood in it is. And the men were so hungry that they didn't even properly cook the food. So they've sinned against God, and why this was a sin is explained in Leviticus 17, which we covered in season 4 of Bible Book Club, episode 10. But God said in verse 11 of that chapter in Leviticus this:
"The life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes the atonement for one's life."
Blood symbolized life and was to be used for one thing only, to atone for life in sacrifices to God. Saul does the right thing here on behalf of the people. He stopped their sinning and built an altar to sacrifice and atone for what they had done by eating the blood. However, we will find that with his own son, Jonathan, he does not do the right thing. He trips over his own pride. Moving on, Saul's thoughts return to the Philistines.
Verse 36, Saul said, "Let us go down and pursue the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn, and let us not leave one of them alive. Do whatever seems best to you," they replied. But the priest said, "Let us inquire of God here." So Saul asked God, "Shall I go down and pursue the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" But God did not answer him that day.
Saul assumes that if God is not answering him, somebody's done something wrong. There's sin somewhere. Why is God not talking to them?
Verse 38, Saul therefore said, "Come here, all you who are leaders of the army, and let us find out what sin has been committed today. As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if the guilt lies with my son Jonathan, he must die." But not one of them said a word. Saul then said to all the Israelites, "You stand over there. I and Jonathan, my son, will stand over here." "Do what seems best to you," they replied. Then Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Why have you not answered your servant today? If the fault is in me or my son Jonathan, respond with Urim. But if the men of Israel are at fault, respond with Thummim." Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot, and the men were cleared. Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and Jonathan, my son," and Jonathan was taken.
Okay, so God's setting him up here. Saul's made another mistake, and God's going to bring it to the light. The Urim and the Thummim were first described in the book of Exodus, chapter 28, season 2. They were used by the high priest to determine God's will. So again, it's like casting lots. Exactly what they look like and how they function, the Urim and Thummim, we do not know. But like I said, it's like casting lots. It was some way of God's way of showing them what the truth was.
Verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you've done." So Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die." Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die, he who has brought us this great deliverance in Israel? Never. As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and they withdrew to their own land. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side: Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them.
All right, this honey thing is ridiculous. And Jonathan's words and the tone he uses, in my head at least, express it. He's saying, "Look, Dad, I tasted a little honey. We're fighting a bloody war. What were you thinking calling for a fast? We can't fight without food. That is the stupidest strategy I've ever heard. And now you're going to kill me for your mistake?" Jonathan knew that his father was losing it. But Saul's pride prevents him from acknowledging the truth. The fast was a mistake. Saul could have acknowledged it. He could have repented and begged God for forgiveness. And trust me, David will do that one day in the future. Saul could have done it here, but he didn't. He tripped over his pride, and he is falling fast. Now, the people see the truth, and they save Jonathan, because in their field, they're in the field fighting with Jonathan, remember. Saul's under the pomegranate tree. The people know what's going down, and they know that Jonathan should not die for eating honey. Saul has fallen so far in such a short time. He has fallen out of favor with God by disobeying him. He has fallen out of favor with Samuel by making decisions without Samuel. He has fallen out of favor with his men by forcing a fast when they're fighting all day. And he has fallen out of favor with his own son by trying to kill Jonathan for his own foolish mistake, rather than asking God for forgiveness, repenting, and releasing, praying that God would release him from this oath. All right, we close out this chapter with a little bit more about Saul's family.
Verse 49, Saul's sons were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua. The name of his older daughter was Merab, and that of the younger daughter was Michal. His wife's name was Anihom, daughter of Ahimaaz. The name of the commander of Saul's army was Abner, son of Ner, and Ner was Saul's uncle. Saul's father Kish and Abner's father Ner were sons of Abiel. All the days of Saul, there was bitter war with the Philistines, and whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service.
In our next episode, we will meet one of the most talked about characters in the Bible, another boy who will be called to be king. But this one has the heart for the job because he has a heart that loves God.
What's a club without friends? If you're enjoying the Bible Book Club, why don't you share it? And then you can say,
Welcome to the club.
New episodes drop every Monday, and
get all episodes now on Amazon Music.
As always, head over to susanmee.com/Bible Book Club for show notes from today's episode. Bible Book Club is hosted by Susan Merrill and Heather Rubio, edited by Buck Buchanan, produced by Haley Mawat.